This podcast is a part of Sphera,
a collective of independent media outlets from across Europe.
For more information,
visit sphera-hub.com.
So I'm back in the office fairly often at the moment, and something that I've noticed is that even though things are tentatively feeling kind of semi-normal again here in Paris, la bise is still not back. Do you know what I mean when I say the bise?
No, I've no idea.
It's the French double kiss thing.
Ah, yeah.
Which in non-COVID times was like a huge waste of everyone's time, because you'd have to turn up at a party and like kiss 15 people one after the other, like... And I used to find it really annoying. But now I'm starting to worry that it's never coming back. And I feel kind of sad about it.
Did you do that at work too?
Sometimes. A colleague was saying there was this one guy who literally used to just go around the office beezing every single person, like a team of 12 people every morning. But that doesn't feel like something that's really doable in a post-COVID world.
I'm not sure it will come back. I mean, in the Netherlands, you do 3 kisses, which also takes a long time, but you wouldn't do it at work. And then in the Netherlands, if you do 1 kiss, then it means you know them really well. It's really intimate. So it's like a bit of a, sometimes feels like a slur if like someone gives you 3 kisses. You're like, oh, I thought we were really close. Oh, well, never mind.
1 kiss is more intimate than 3?
Yeah.
Is it on the mouth?
Not usually, no.
Anyway, I would be really interested to hear about some other like regionally specific cultural things that seem to have changed during COVID around Europe, because this definitely isn't the only one.
I'd also like to hear.
Kisses aside, what are we talking about in the show this week?
Well, this week we're going to be heading to Belarus. Last week, you may have seen that a Belarusian court sentenced one of the opposition leaders, Maria Kolesnikova, to 11 years in jail, which briefly brought back into the headlines this huge protest movement against Alexander Lukashenko, which grabbed so much international attention during the summer of 2020. Today, we're speaking to someone who has been really in the middle of this protest movement, a Belarusian poet and activist called Hanna Komar. We're going to be speaking to Hanna about the extraordinary solidarity that she witnessed and experienced herself between the women who ended up in jail after protesting against Lukashenko. We'll be speaking to her later on in the show about her own experience and to find out what the situation more generally is like now in Belarus. But first...
Who has had a bad week, Dominic?
It's been a pretty bad week for Europe's dependence on Russia. After it was announced that the controversial gas pipeline known as Nord Stream 2, which runs from Russia to Germany via the Baltic Sea, was completed.
I'm really glad that you're talking about this week, because yeah, it's one of those things that's been around for years, but like you don't really know what it's all about. It's a bit like, you know, one of those colleagues where you've been walking past their desk for like years and years, and it's way too late to ask them what their name is.
Yes, and it gets awkward that you're like not saying hello to them.
This is how I feel about Nord Stream 2, so tell me all about it.
I've actually felt like that too, and I'm kind of half glad that we're talking about it and half scared that people are going to switch off. I'll try and make it fun. Well, that's kind of not true. It's not going to be fun, but it's going to be okay.
Great.
And it's not online yet. That's the first thing you should know. It may be completed, but there's no actual natural gas making its way through all those pipes yet. But it does bring this very controversial project, which has cost almost 10 billion euros, a big step closer to reality. And it's a reality that many thought or hoped would never happen. Broadly, that is because of the concern that it will make Europe more dependent on Russia for its energy needs and energy security than it has been before. Probably goes without saying that this is all due to the fact that Russia is led by someone called Vladimir Putin, who isn't exactly the European Union's best bud at the moment.
That's really rude.
Deal with it. But the country that is arguably most concerned about the pipeline is not in the European Union, but an ally of the Union, Ukraine.
Didn't the Ukrainian president describe this pipeline thingy as like a geopolitical weapon that Russia could use against Europe?
I thought you didn't know anything about this.
Did a little bit of research.
Okay, well done. Indeed he did. Yeah, why exactly he said that, I'll try and explain it a bit. But first, it's probably important to know that Up until now, Ukraine has been a vital transit route for much of Russia's export of gas to European customers. And this means a few things. It means that Ukraine made quite a significant amount of money charging for the transit of the gas through their pipelines. Mm. And this is going to be pretty painful economically, potentially, for Ukraine, as gradually it is expected that Russia will divert their gas into the new pipeline, which bypasses Ukraine. Some of the worst fears from critics of the pipeline is that it could mean that Russia behave even more aggressively towards Ukraine, because it will no longer need to use the Ukrainian gas infrastructure to transport their gas to key European customers. Russia did earlier this year position temporarily over 100,000 troops near the border of Ukraine. And of course, they also annexed the Crimean Peninsula back in 2014. So Ukrainian fears of some kind of Russian invasion haven't just emerged out of the blue.
I also read, despite not knowing very much about this, that our American friends don't like this project very much either. Is this one of the reasons?
Yeah, in some ways it's been a bit surprising that politicians in the USA have had such strong feelings about this one pipeline, even though the USA is very far away geographically. But I guess large geopolitical power struggles make big geographical distances irrelevant. And the pipeline was weirdly one of the few things that both Trump and Biden can agree on, in that they were opposed to it. And
unity.
The US efforts did actually slow down the completion of the pipeline. Although in the end, Biden decided not to take a hard line in opposing the pipeline and came to a compromise with Merkel, because of course, Merkel's been pulling the strings here and has been the person who's really backed this on the European side, somewhat controversially. Defenders of the new pipeline think it isn't such a big deal, seeing as Europe currently already receives about a third of its gas from Russia. But
wow.
The new pipeline will significantly increase Russia's capacity for providing gas to Europe. And it wasn't that long ago that Russia actually did cut off gas to Europe. Back in 2009, as part of a dispute with Ukraine, the state-owned Russian gas company Gazprom temporarily suspended the supply of gas to Europe in the middle of winter. So the concerns from Ukraine and from the US, and indeed from EU countries like France and Poland, sit in that historical context. And yeah, some have been a bit surprised that Merkel backed Nord Stream 2 so strongly, and in doing so, was accused of backing Russia ahead of Germany's supposed American allies.
Mm.
She has, however, secured compromises for the US and Ukraine and other pipeline skeptical countries. She's agreed that Germany will automatically impose sanctions if Russia misuses the pipeline politically. And Germany are also supporting renewable projects in Ukraine worth 1 billion euros to try and help them out with the potential economic damage.
And what are Russia saying about all of this controversy?
Yeah, they are just very pleased that the pipeline is completed. And they, of course, play down any controversy. They say it's not a political deal. It's a business deal. But Gazprom, the oil company that runs the new pipeline, is a state-owned company. So business and politics are certainly overlapping a bit here. And before I stop talking about this, there is, of course, also the climate opposition to this gas pipeline, which is often ignored or gets lost amidst all the geopolitical angst. Many environmentalists are asking, why are we building another gas pipeline for Europe when we're meant to be weaning ourselves off gas?
Mm.
And that's actually a good question. Merkel herself responds to the critique by saying, we cannot, as some have demanded, get out of nuclear power and coal and then withdraw from natural gas as fast as possible. That's not going to be possible. And the German government line is that natural gas produces much less CO2 than alternative fossil fuels. But this argument is, of course, not convincing to environmental activists in Germany who believe that Germany is not, and yeah, for a long time has not been doing enough to avoid catastrophic climate change.
And when are we going to get our hands on some of this sweet, sweet natural gas?
It's expected to take about 4 months for the German regulator to get all the paperwork in order. Classic slow German bureaucracy. But it looks like they will approve it. So yeah, bad week for Europe's dependence on Russia.
I didn't think that was that boring.
Oh, good. I'm pleased. Who's had a good week, Katie?
It has been a good week for the Labour Party in Norway, who have just won an election after 8 years of government led by the Conservatives under Erna Solberg, aka Iron Erna. I have to confess, I hadn't really been following this election that closely until now, but it's actually been a really interesting one because it's been very green in theme. Do you remember that UN climate report that came out last month? The one that was like, no, really, we are completely doomed.
Yeah, the one that actually seemed to grab some people's attention.
Yeah, and one of the places where it really struck a chord was Norway, which, as you may recall, is the biggest oil producer in Western Europe. There's a bit of an oily, gassy theme going on in this week's good week, bad week. Sorry, that's a horrible way of putting it. But yeah, that report helped to shape this election campaign. And the future of oil and whether to end Norway's very lucrative oil industry, that became a central theme of this election.
So Labour won. And is that because they pitched themselves as like a super environmental anti-oil party?
They definitely weren't the ones calling for the most urgent and radical action on this. The Green Party of Norway were a lot more forceful, perhaps unsurprisingly. They called for an end to the oil industry by 2035. Labour didn't go that far, and neither did the Conservatives. They were both mindful of the fact that, you know, this is a huge industry in Norway. Tens of thousands of jobs depend on oil. And oil is also, of course, the thing that has made the country so rich historically. The Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, the biggest fund of its kind in the world, was built on oil. So it's not a clean-cut issue. And actually, both Labour and the Conservatives have factions that really want the party to emphasise speeding up the transition to green energy a lot faster. But for now, Labour's leader, Jonas Gahr Støre, he's declined to say, like, yeah, we're going to end the oil industry. And he said that he thinks the exit from oil should be a lot more gradual.
And so is this the guy that's going to be Prime Minister then?
Yes, very probably. Although, as with all your fave European elections, nothing is certain because they've got to put together a coalition first. But yeah, Stiller is probably going to be Prime Minister. And he is quite an intriguing character because his main campaign message was about social equality and like boosting investment in education and other public services. But he's a millionaire himself.
No.
So he's been a political advisor slash public servant for most of his career. But his granddad sold the family business, which I think made cooking stoves or something. And Stiller was lucky enough to inherit from that fortune. So he's an interesting figure. He hasn't always been beloved on the left because he doesn't exactly cut a man of the people image. He was educated at Sciences Po in Paris. He went to Harvard for a bit.
Where you teach.
Yes, exactly. What a great school.
Did you teach him?
Did I teach the new Prime Minister of Norway? No, he's a little bit older than me. He comes across as this like elite technocrat kind of guy, but he has campaigned pretty hard on the need for more equality. One of the things that Erna Solberg got criticized for is the fact that Norway has got more unequal while she's been in charge. So even though Norway is still one of the countries in Europe with the lowest extremes in incomes, I think the number of billionaires doubled during her government.
That's a trend that's not unique to Norway in recent decades, though.
It's true.
So is that going to be the first thing on the agenda for the new government when they get themselves together?
It'll definitely be a big thing on their agenda, but it will depend a bit on who ends up being in government. So Labour and their two preferred coalition partners, the Centre Party and the Socialist Left, between them, they actually won an absolute majority, just over 50% of the seats. So that will make things a little bit easier for Labour. I was kind of interested to see if Labour might be forced to team up with a wider range of smaller parties, because that might force them to, for example, have a more ambitious policy when it comes to the whole green energy, ending oil thing. Mm. And it was interesting to see that while Støre is talking primarily to the socialists and the centre, he is also talking to the Greens and the Communists. So we'll have to see what kind of government comes out of this. It's probably going to take a few weeks at least, because it always does here in Europe. But in the meantime, good week for the Norwegian left. And good week, in fact, for the Nordic left, because the whole region is now left-wing again.
Yeah, I actually read somewhere someone suggesting that there's like a growing trend of left-wing parties doing a bit better in Europe, or at least in parts of Europe, due to the fact that climate is like going up the list of people's priorities when they're choosing who to vote for.
Definitely. Good thing to remember next time some commentator says that the left is dead.
We are so very grateful to those of you who support us on Patreon. I really mean it when I say we wouldn't still be doing this without you. But we still do need more support to make this podcast viable long term. So if you have any spare money, then we'd be ever so grateful if you'd give a little bit of it to us each month. You can support us on Patreon from as little as $2 or pounds or euros a month. So you could just think of it as like buying Katie a croissant each month. We promise she won't spend it all on croissants, but, you know, it helps.
I know I shouldn't be confessing this to someone that is applying for French nationality, but I don't really like croissants that much.
That's insane. France is wasted on you.
I'm a pain au chocolat girl. Always have been.
Anyway, we've got a new supporter to thank this week. Who is it, Katie?
It's Ignace. Thank you so much, Ignace.
You can join Ignace by heading to patreon.com/Europeans podcast.
You know, time has been doing such weird things of late that I don't really believe it's been a year since the protests broke out in Belarus. But it really has been a year, more than a year now. It was in August last year that Belarus held a presidential election, and the world watched as Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, a charismatic former teacher, took over the candidacy of her husband, who had been jailed, and she galvanized the opposition. It was an incredible thing to watch. She fought that election, and then again, we watched as Alexander Lukashenko, the man who has held an incredibly repressive rule over this European country since 1994, he claimed to have won 80% of the vote, despite widespread allegations of fraud. That election was not the end of the story, as we all know. It gave birth to a huge pro-democracy protest movement, calling for Lukashenko to step down. Thousands of people got arrested, often very violently. And we were gripped by what was happening in Belarus for weeks, some of us for months. But as the months have gone on, the world's attention has turned to other things, and Belarus isn't all over our TV screens anymore. But the movement goes on. So we wanted to check in with someone in Minsk to see how things are going a year into that movement. And we had the good fortune to speak to someone who speaks very, very powerfully about it, the poet, activist, and translator Hannah Komar. Over the summer, an article of Hannah's caught our eye about her own experience of being jailed during the opposition protests. It's a very beautiful article about the solidarity that she experienced with other women behind bars. We will put a link to that in the show notes, but for now, here's Hannah Komar.
How is life in Belarus right now?
Life is hard in Belarus right now. It seems like a quiet phase, but a lot is going on under the surface. And a lot of terror and a lot of repressions are going on. But unlike last year, that people were talking and speaking out, we knew about every detention and every arrest and every dismissal. And now people keep quiet a lot. When they are detained or arrested or interrogated, we just don't know that. It's kind of like a dangerous phase now, because a lot of people think that if nothing loud is going on, that they gave up on their fight, which is not true. And also, there are a lot of processes going on in people's, a lot of psychological stuff. Something is going on inside every individual, and some transformation is going on in every individual. And I think that's really important, but not visible to an eye.
You were imprisoned yourself last autumn. Can you tell us a little bit about how you ended up in jail in the first place and what it was like there?
Yeah, actually, it's anniversary, if you can say so, of the day when I was detained and imprisoned for 9 days. It was just a usual regular evening. Every day we would take to the streets and protest peacefully, just by walking maybe, or going out with posters, with signs showing our demands. The day before, Maria Kolesnikova was brought to the Belarusian-Ukrainian border. They wanted to kick her out of the country by force, but she refused and she tore her passport so that they couldn't get her out of the country against her will. And she got imprisoned, and we went out to support her. We were not many people, maybe 200, 300 people, mostly women. And so we were encircled down and blocked by the people in the uniforms. They wanted to take men first, but we women said no. And so in the end, they detained a lot of women, I think over 100. And I spent 9 days in jail, like many others. I always say it's like a light version of what it could be compared, for example, to the beginning of August, to the first nights of the protest when people were detained in thousands and when prison cell for four people could be stuffed with 50 people. And there were a lot of beaten and tortured and raped and all the horrifying things. So each of us probably expect something horrible to happen, beatings or maybe rape. And I was anxious about that as well. But mostly it was awfully stressful because you didn't know what to expect. And they try to play with you, you know, so that you never feel safe and never feel secure. And so that they have complete power over you. And they make jokes that make you worried. Not just misogynistic jokes, but jokes like they want to pick up one of us for themselves, you know, like which one they like. And you are like, oh my God, are they really gonna do this?
And presumably you're sharing the cell with the eight of you and you don't know the people you're sharing a cell with. But I read in your piece that you get to know them pretty well and you were actually quite moved by the solidarity between the women in prison together. Could you describe a bit about what your days were like together with these other women in prison?
It gave me a warm feeling when I realized that we could connect immediately. Each of us felt what she could do, what her role was. It was unspoken. We talked about the most intimate things, and it was so easy to talk about those things as if we'd been friends for years. And we played games and we sang and danced and shared everything. We shared food and we shared clothes and we shared toiletries, books, nightmares, everything.
Why do you think the prisoners grew close so quickly in that environment?
Because this is a way of survival. When you are together and when you're connected, you can find some shared solutions. And you also need this comfort, emotional comfort.
You write in your piece also about the solidarity from outside prison and that there is now a kind of algorithm for what to do when a woman or a sister is detained by the police. Can you outline a bit how this practical process of solidarity is activated and what it looks like?
When a person gets to prison, we know where to look for that person. So you call the police stations and find out where the person is. And then you know that once a week, they accept care packages for the imprisoned people. And you prepare that and bring that to prison. And you find a lawyer as well. So we come to the court hearing to support our friends. And then we wait for her or him. And while waiting for her, we plan how to cheer her up and we prepare all that, like nice presents and vitamins, medication if needed, something nice to enjoy herself after her release, like manicure, you know, or a massage or whatever, or psychological help as well. And then we greet the person when she is released.
We heard recently that Maria Kolesnikova, one of the protest leaders, has been handed a jail term of 11 years. Do you know anything about what the conditions in jail are like for high-profile prisoners like Maria? And do you think that she will be able to receive any of the assistance and solidarity from the sisterhood that you experienced?
They can't see the support because they don't receive letters or receive very few of them. Maybe of 100 letters, Maria received 10. Probably there is pressure from the side of people who try to persuade them that they are forgotten and that all they are doing and all they have been doing is in vain, you know, and that everybody is going to forget about them and that nobody cares. I'm sure that this is what they are trying to, you know, be made to believe. But we support them also, you know, by coming to the courts, to the trials, just maybe to send energy and to support their relatives so that they can see that their children are heroes for us and they are not forgotten and we do care about them. And we write about them, you know, and I know concerts are organized and other events and there are articles published about these people and we exchange information constantly as well.
Many of the most prominent leaders of this movement have been women, like Maria, like Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. Why do you think that is? Why have women been playing such a prominent role in these protests in general?
I'm not surprised because women are great in the first place and women are very strong and powerful. But you know, why it happened here is a coincidence. Initially, these women went out instead of the men, so they kind of represented men. Zetlana Tikhanovskaya represented her husband. Veronika Tsepkala, she also stepped in instead of her husband. And Maria Kolesnikova stepped in for Viktor Babaryka. And I think that's how they managed to unite a lot of people of different layers, of different genders. Other women could see an example, you know, in them. On the other hand, they stepped in instead of men, so men could also trust them.
Belarus is obviously a country where freedom of speech and expression is increasingly being restricted. Does your poetry feel like a form of resistance?
Yes, my poetry does feel like a form of resistance. Over the last year, I've been writing only about the topics related to these revolution or revolution of dignity, as we call it. It's not just poetry, but also prose. And I'm happy about it. It's a totally new level for me. When from your own, your personal things, you switch to this more like nationwide or global things, if you can say so, or just meaningful for so many more people. Yeah, but it's not easy to be a poet here now, because with this kind of poetry, I cannot perform openly and I cannot publish it. Even my book, my poetry collection, can only be published if I remove these poems from it, which I am not going to do. So I'm proud of my poetry, but it's hard to be this kind of poet now in Belarus.
Lots of pro-democracy activists have left Belarus. They've gone to Poland or Lithuania or elsewhere. Are you not tempted to join these people who have left? Are you scared to stay where you are?
It comes and goes. I am worried about myself and I've been feeling pretty anxious, concerned about my safety. But from the very beginning, I promised that I would leave on two occasions. One would be if I was in danger of getting imprisoned. And second is my master's degree in London, because I had applied for the Chivnin Scholarship. I am now going to London actually to do my master's degree in creative writing, because I received the scholarship. But otherwise, I would stay, because I believe it's important to stay and see and feel what's going on from the inside. Because once you've left Belarus, you get disconnected. You don't feel people anymore. You don't really know what's going on here, what's on people's minds and what's in people's hearts. And as a poet, it's essential for me to get these vibes from here. But now as I'm leaving, I'm just going to process, you know, what I've collected and hopefully produce some works that will be helpful for my people to heal their wounds.
We think it's really important to carry on talking about what's happening in Belarus on this podcast. And we're hoping to talk to someone in the coming weeks about the situation on Belarus's borders with the EU, where there is this huge row going on about migration and asylum seekers being used basically as a geopolitical weapon by the regime. So do look out for that in the weeks to come. In the meantime, stay tuned till the end of the show when we're going to play a recording of a poem of Hannah's, one of many that she's written about her experiences over the past year. Which brings us to this week's Isolation Inspiration. What have you been listening to or watching this week?
I got back into a podcast that I've listened to for a long time but had neglected for a while. You know how it happens. It's called Song Exploder, and I'm sure many, many people have heard of it. It's even got its own Netflix spin-off these days, which I don't think is as good as the OG podcast. If you haven't heard it, it's about the creation process behind pop songs. And in each episode, an artist gives the backstory behind how they wrote and produced one of their songs. And before Katie tells me off for recommending an American podcast, I'm mentioning it for a good reason, because the two episodes I listened to this week just so happened to be both from Swedish artists. Not ABBA, don't worry.
I was going to say.
The first episode I listened to was just from a few weeks ago, and it features Lykke Li.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, breaking down the writing process of her breakout hit, I Follow Rivers. Even if you've never heard of her and never heard of this song, you probably will recognize the song when you hear it. It was used, I think, really well in the smash hit movie Blue is the Warmest Color, or La Vie d'Adèle. And in the episode, you hear the story of how the song came into existence with really colourful anecdotes of exactly where they were and how they were feeling when particular elements of the song came together. And it pointed out, which I thought was quite interesting, that actually I Follow Rivers, the title, is not even in the lyrics, which is something I had never noticed until she said it. And it was because one of the producers like makes her title her songs really early on in the process to like give it a framework, which I found interesting. Anyway, I'll stop talking about it. The other Swede whose episode I listened to was the Swedish superstar Robin, who talks about the making of Honey. That's also really fascinating, although that one's back from 2019. I really love the format of the podcast, and I think if you haven't listened, then I highly recommend it to you all. The host, Hrishikesh Hirway, you hardly ever hear his voice, but it feels like he's really subtly pulling the strings and bringing out these gems of anecdotes from these musicians to share with us all. So go back and listen to these Swedish tracks and, yeah, all the other non-Swedish artists talk about how they make their pop hits.
I do actually really like the TV version as well, though.
Oh, really?
Hmm.
Yeah, maybe it was just that I wasn't that interested in the songs.
I watched the Dua Lipa one. That's European. Counts, right?
Yeah, Kosovan British.
There you go.
I love Dua Lipa. She was like my lockdown music. Anyway, I feel like we've been talking about Song Exploder for ages now. What have you been enjoying, Katie?
This week I have been dipping into the Book of Reykjavik, which is a collection of 10 short stories about the capital of Iceland. I found it very charming indeed. For obvious reasons, like everyone else, haven't been traveling that much over the last couple of years. And this was a really fun way to get to know a city I've never been to, and in a way that feels really different from, like, you know, reading a tourist guide about a city, because it's fiction, which allows you to get into the heads of people that live there a little bit better. So I really recommend this series in general, actually. It's a really nice series of books called Reading the City. They are published by a small publisher in the UK called Comma Press. And it's the same concept for every city. They are collections of 10 stories from prominent authors from that place, translated into English. And there's quite a few of them now for different cities around Europe. There's one from Barcelona, Riga, Venice, Tbilisi. And then further afield, they've done ones for like Gaza, Shanghai, all around the world. And yeah, I think it's a really nice concept, especially at a time when we can't travel.
Sounds great. I'll check them out.
The Icelandic one is really very nice. It's a very witty foreword written by the poet Sion about how Icelanders view their capital in like fairly derogatory terms. And you just get this really nice glimpse into Reykjavik as a city that loves literature and has a really interesting relationship with the wilderness around it, and a city that has problems like any other. So yeah, really recommend it. The Book of Reykjavik.
I was, like much of the rest of the world, completely blown away by the incredible story of 18-year-old Emma Raducanu, who came out of nowhere and won the US Open last week.
Woohoo!
So I thought she deserved my happy ending. She broke so many records, perhaps the most incredible of which is that she was the first person to win a Grand Slam tennis title having come into the competition through qualification, as opposed to getting an automatic place due to ranking as one of the top 100 or so players.
Hmm.
I find that incredible. She was a 400-1 outsider, according to the bookies, before the tournament. I wonder if anyone actually placed a bet on her. Now that would be a happy ending.
Damn it, that's a trick.
Yeah. Anyway, Emma is the first British woman to win a Grand Slam since Virginia Wade won Wimbledon in 1977. But she's not just British. She was born in Canada to a Romanian father, a Chinese mother, and was brought up in London. Now she's being tipped by PR experts as being a candidate to become Britain's first ever billion-dollar sports star, which is perhaps a ridiculous thing to be suggesting and something that will probably set quite a lot of people's alarm bells going. I am myself a bit scared for teenagers when I see them catapult into the world's spotlight like this. It must be an insane experience, but she seems so calm and level-headed about it. I was watching a few interviews of her and she's totally thrilled, of course. And in one of the post-match interviews, she said she just hadn't looked at her phone yet. And that was a few days afterwards, which I thought was quite a good sign if she's not like diving into social media too much and the horrors that are there. And she's probably not even seen the message that she got from a little known someone called the Queen. She said she doesn't feel any pressure. She said, I'm still only 18 years old. I'm just having a swing at anything that comes my way, which I just thought was an amazing attitude. And I hope it carries on being so fun for her.
Me too. I would also like to have $2.5 million, please. We will be back next week. Isn't it nice that we get to say that again?
Yes, although I am moving house next week, so it's quite stressful for me to think about making a podcast and rehearsing and moving house. But yes, sure.
It'll be fine. Just breathe. So it's goodbye from us for now, but do hang on after the credits for a poem from Hannah to close out the show. It is a very moving poem about the agonizing wait for news about her friend Sergei, who disappeared a year ago at the height of the protests. There was no news from him for 3 days, and then finally he turned up in a hospital, covered in bruises. It was a very common experience at the time to have friends and loved ones go missing like this, and we wanted to give Hannah a chance to share the poem that she wrote about it. It's called We Couldn't Find You. This podcast was produced by me and Wojciech Oleksiak. Our senior producer is Kat Slazlo. We are part of the Are We Europe family. Find more European podcasts at the link in the show notes.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Here's Hannah with We Couldn't Find You.
That night on Ought Dial. Dial tones first like batoons, then like rubber bullets directed at you. 130, 131. Long tone, like a mourning face on concrete. Kicked from unconsciousness, 3 days without food. There is no answer to all our white flowers and red hearts. Human body and memory withstand interests incompatible with our belief in the better. We rename the colors to fear and anxiety, mourning, loving, resistance and hope. When it's all over, I will help you paint this bare wall.